Well, welcome on behalf of the European Institute of London School of Economics for this public lecture. I always have this onerous task of introducing people who are so much more famous than myself that I feel deeply embarrassed. I always feel I should start introducing myself and not them. But our guest today has a distinguished career in academia. We agreed after some bargaining that I will not call him a politician, but I'll call him a technopole, because he was, after all, a foreign minister of Portugal. But he tells me that he didn't do any of the hard, slightly muddy slog work that politicians do. So he's free of sleaze, and he's as pure as driven snow. Then, of course, he's currently commissioner in the European Commission on behalf of Portugal, and of course he has been at the heart of the European Union's development policy. He is going to speak to us about development policy, and I think we would like to leave a lot of time for questions afterwards. So I think without any further ado, I will cut all these things short and ask him to give us a speak. Commissioner Pinheiro, thank you.
Thanks very much, Chairman. Let me say how proud I am to be hosted this evening by this renowned institution. Renowned abroad, I can assure you, as much as at home. The London School of Economics and Political Science. Important to be careful to give the school its full title. Has a well-merited reputation for openness in its attitudes, open to all schools of thought, and in particular, open to foreigners and their non-British or un-British view of the world. Karl Popper's idea of the open society, though invented while the great man was still a foreigner, was spread from this place during his 20 years as your professor of logic. Despite the fall of communism, the open society still has its enemies in some parts of the world. I shall be coming to that. But let me first give way a little to the feelings of pride and self-congratulations any professor feels when addressing an audience in this noble school. It is, of course, not far from my mind that the predecessor of mine as European Commissioner, Professor Rolf Dahrendorf, became director of the LSE, despite the handicap of beginning his career as a foreigner. Now, I'm not myself looking for a job in the immediate future, and present no threat to your new director. But with my ego and self-esteem inflated by your invitation to speak here, a humble professor of chemical engineering can be permitted to dream. At any rate, I shall be on my best behavior this evening, so long as I am under your roof. I have used this trip to London to make my first contacts in the Foreign Office and the Department for International Development. I warmly congratulated the Secretary of State, of course, on their electoral victory, but also on the course they have already charted for the management of foreign relations, notably in the mission statement for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. I look forward immensely to working with the new British ministers. It seems to me that their instincts, their attitudes, their approaches to Europe and to development cooperation are right. Right for Europe, right for the developing countries, and, if I may for a moment intervene in your national politics, right also for the UK. I do not wish to imply by that a criticism on my dear friend Linda Chalker, Claire Short's predecessor. I greatly admire Linda Chalker as a brave worker for the cause of development, whose immense experience and expertise were always readily and generously put at my disposal. Sometimes, perhaps, I and other in the partner countries thought her instincts were not quite in the right place, but nobody has ever doubted that her heart is in the right place, and it is a big heart. However, she worked in adverse circumstances, both in London and in Brussels. On the other hand, Clare Short has a seat in the cabinet and has command of an independent Department of State. She's a member of a government which puts human rights and democracy at the top of its agenda. She's welcome in Brussels. This augurs very well for Britain's influence, for the good in Europe, and in particular for the sector which is my special concern. Ladies and gentlemen, human rights, democracy, the rule of law, good governance, these four elements figure prominently in the present Lomé Convention, which governs the European Union's relations with developing countries of Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific. That convention runs out in the year 2000, and I want to ensure that a successor convention gives even more prominence to them. I am in London, in part, to enlist the support of the government and the other British actors in the development field for that objective. There are two reasons why this is at the forefront of my mind. First, a general reason. There is no doubt in my mind, and I think there is no doubt in the minds of the British government, that these elements form the second foundation stone for fruitful development and fruitful relations between nations. The first foundation is, of course, peace within nations and between nations. A great concern of mine is to find the means by which Europe's resources can be used to end conflict where it exists, and in particular, to avoid conflict arising in the first place. In a minute, I will talk about what we are doing in the area of conflict prevention. However, once peace is ensured, responsible and accountable government, respectful of the rights of citizens, is the best basis on which to build a prosperous and stable nation. This is not so much a doctrine as a simple observed fact. My academic discipline is chemical engineering, and therefore have a great respect for facts, while also waiting to know in depth what they can account for the observed fact. There is no universal rule, but we have seen in many different times and places that successful development of a nation depends upon the will of the people to develop themselves. We have also seen that success strengthens the will to succeed further. On the other hand, citizens who are subject to arbitrary oppression, who feel they have no secure rights and no part to play in the destinies of their country, lose the will to contribute to their own development, let alone that of others. In the fight against poverty, we have observed the fact that dictators not only rob the people of their money and possessions, but also of their dignity. Oppression is a cause of poverty. Poverty enfeebles the capacity to resist oppression. It attenuates the will to develop, and all sense of duty and of service is lost. Therefore, observance of these four principles is not a luxury which can be afforded only by countries which have developed. It is essential to healthy development in the first place. My second reason for seeking British support is a specific one. It has to do with Britain, the genius of its people and its original contribution to the best of contemporary political thought and practice. Good governance, a phrase of the 17th century British political parlance, has its roots deep in British political tradition. Civil liberties were extolled by John Locke and the rights of man by Tom Paine before these principles were propounded on a wider stage by the American and French revolutions and in the 20th century enshrined in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. The wheel has now come round full circle. The old concept of good governance is back in favor as a chapeau covering a spectrum of desirable political, administrative, and legal practices. As the basis of our Article 5 of the Lomé Convention, it is the cornerstone of European development cooperation. This country became and remains an habitable and civilized place, and a prosperous one, not just because you pioneered the Industrial Revolution, but also because you discovered and upheld the essential features of good governance, human rights, democracy, the rule of law, and of course, living in peace with one another and your neighbors. Therefore, a British commitment to these principles as a special credibility and a special force of example. Equally, if the UK falters or fails when the going gets rough, that failure has a special negative resonance in Europe and around the world. It is no simple matter to implement the policy the new government has announced with such welcome enthusiasm. I hope the new British ministers and their counterparts in the partner countries of the European Union will agree when the moment comes to proceed with the care and caution my recent experience has caused me to observe. For instance, we cannot impose a detailed pattern on other countries. Democracy takes very diverse forms in Europe. The fact that France's head of state is directly elected, while the UK's head of state holds her post by right of inheritance, does not make you less democratic. We must also tolerate diversity in Africa and elsewhere. Also, we must, I think, not be distracted by the level of democracy, by the level of governance of citizens' rights, or just how good or bad the governance is. For me, the direction is all, or speaking in mathematical terms, more important than the value of the function, it's its first derivative. A country which is heading in the right direction has to be encouraged and helped, even though its current level of achievement may be relatively low. Per contra, if a highly democratic government starts moving in the wrong direction, discouragement must be swiftly organized. Sanctions are easy to apply to developing countries which misbehave. We have all the weapons on our side, crude though some of them are. We can cut the aid, cut the trade, cut the contact. Positive measures are more difficult to find. It is worrying that the list of punishments is longer than the list of rewards. And I hope British ingenuity and experience might be mobilized to develop the means of encouragement. And to pay for that, because at the end of the day, we are talking about spending money. Indeed, we find ourselves spending money over and over again. You pay to help build a parliament. You pay to rebuild it after it is burned down during the coup, perhaps more than once. You have a graphic saying in English idiom, which is, put your money where your mouth is. After some years of steady decrease in the real value of UK aid programs, and following some welcome words from the new minister, all of us with an interest in development cooperation will be watching the figures for signs of a reversal of the trend. Ladies and gentlemen, for 2 or 3 years now, I've been working on conflict prevention. And I am delighted I was able to persuade the European Union Council of Ministers to reach agreed conclusions just 2 weeks ago on the Union's handling of these important concepts. I also acknowledge a lot of support from influential members of the European Parliament, non-governmental organizations, and academics. I hasten to assure you that we have not been discussing conflict resolution. I do not picture myself as one of those heroic shuttle diplomats rushing from capital to capital, always within the sound of gunfire, without rest or sleep. That is not European Commission's vocation, and certainly not my ideal lifestyle. The heroes of the process are not single persons, but are numbered by the thousands. They do not succeed or fail in a few weeks, but over several years. It used to be said, notably by Couve de Mourville, the Gaulle's foreign minister, that the best diplomacy is invisible. By the time I became my country's foreign minister, this obiter dicta was of doubtful validity. However, in the case of conflict prevention, it may well be true. The product of successful conflict prevention is not usually a public document proclaimed on CNN by exhausted participants in a very visible negotiation. At its best, the product is nothing. Long term, good quality nothing. No news, nothing happened. The market is, as usual, full of traders. The National Assembly is debating something very boring. The weather continues fair with occasional showers. The Prime Minister is playing golf. The leader of the opposition is giving a children's party for his daughter. The Army Chief of Staff is asleep. The Chief of Security Police has gone shopping with his wife. The CNN has closed its local bureau, for there is no news. But for the population and for us, this is great news. We have sustainable peace. We have structural stability. If you look around Africa today, if you watch what CNN is reporting and count the number of countries where CNN has nothing to report, you will find that the number is growing. The objective of the European Union and its member states is to ensure the list of stable countries grows longer and faster. The concept of structural stability is a central one. It requires intelligence, understanding, cooperation, and coordination on the part of all the actors in development cooperation, notably those in the partner country. For those outside the partner country, very special delicacy is required. Almost all potential conflicts are internal, and very delicate issues of sovereignty are in play, and there is an extra special need to ensure local ownership of the process. Effective peace building requires a rethink on the part of the donors on the way in which they use their instruments for development, and indeed a rethink of some of our basic philosophies. It used to be received wisdom that economic development ensured structural stability. We have learned the hard way that good economic measures can have divisive social effects. Therefore, economic and social development must go hand in hand. The next lesson we have to learn is, in my view, is that economic and social development do not lead alone to stability. There is a causal link, but it works the other way around. Structural stability is a precondition of successful, sustainable economic and social development. So the idea of diffusing in advance potential internal conflict is not just an end in itself. The process is part of the necessary work of building firm and stable foundations for development. Foundations like the best diplomacy are, of course, invisible. As I puzzled my way through this problem, I found other challenges to the philosophies I had absorbed and observed. I had to redefine my notions on the link between democracy and stability, because so many of the internal conflicts we have seen in Africa and Europe have arisen in countries with a democratic government, or at least a democratically elected government. It is apparent now that we do not eliminate the potential for conflict simply by eliminating authoritarian dictatorships. We have to look a little deeper to work out where the causes of instability are lurking, to seek them out and neutralize them. I begin to think that the key concept in terms of governance is really accountability. If governments are responsive to movements of opinion in civil society, they have a chance of establishing a structural stable state and a structural stable society. This is rather an uncomfortable conclusion, because a dictatorship can be responsive and in some senses accountable, and an elected government can be lacking in a sense of responsibility or accountability to those who elect it. We have to comfort ourselves by saying that this may be the case in very special circumstances, but not for very long. Structural stability has, of course, to be built from the bottom up as well as from the top down. That is why I say the peace builders are numbered in thousands and can include many in this audience. Building a strong civil society is a process in which business people, non-governmental organizations, and even academics can, maybe should, participate on condition that they are mindful of the sensitivities of that society and on the fault lines running through it. it is easier to describe how not to do it. Investors who plan on a quick return or a quick exit work against stability. So do NGOs, which mount a showpiece project and then abandon it for a more picturesque opportunity elsewhere. Donor agencies who respond simply to the emergencies, social or economic, of the moment are not doing their full duty. If all of us work for sustainable investment, sustainable development, and take the time and patience to understand the internal dynamics of the societies with which we cooperate, which requires paying attention to the patient academic, there we can all make a contribution. This is not too much to ask. Had we been adventurers, seekers for profit or glory, reckless of our impact on the societies in which we work, we should never have committed ourselves to the labor of development cooperation in the first place. Working for structural stability also means abandoning some of our prejudices, accepting that some of our store of received wisdom is not relevant or is simply wrong. That is not too much to ask either. Show me a developer, if that word exists, who has not changed her or his mind about the real nature of development at least once a decade, and I will show you a failed developer. In this business, the unforgivable failures are the failure to learn, the failure to listen, the failure to be persuaded to think again. I have been persuaded to think again. I have persuaded the Council of Ministers to think again. I hope I have persuaded some of you to think again. Ladies and gentlemen, it is unusual to listen to a speech made by a minister concerned with development in the north or in the south without hearing the words that I will quote: the private sector is the engine for development, or only the private sector can create investment and the jobs required to full development. I have heard those phrases 100 times, often coming out of my own mouth. They have become truisms, but I would like to spend a few minutes on the conditions for private sector development and the role in need of development cooperation. First, there is the strong connection between private sector development, highly commercial matter, and democracy, good governance, etc., those highly political issues I have just been talking about. In Africa and Europe, businessmen of good sense and good standing constantly tell me that they will be encouraged to invest in those countries which develop open and stable political and economic systems. A credible commitment to good, equitable, stable, predictable, and participative governance, the rule of law, and efficient administration of justice is essential to business confidence and thus a precondition for investment. Sad to say, the common perception of investors that business in much of sub-Saharan Africa is excessively risky and that operating costs are too high owes much to bad governance and corruption in past decades. Fortunately, Africa is now changing. Governments increasingly listen to their private sectors, explain their policies, and open them to debate. Second, the day-to-day workings of public administrations must be fair, uncorrupt, prompt, and friendly to the legitimate needs of the private sector. It still happens that the people who determine policy are convinced, but those who do the work are not. Not yet, at least. European businessmen tell me they hear from African ministers very encouraging words and up-to-date thinking, but that the working level attitudes have not changed since the days of Marxist-Leninist economic philosophy, in which the ordinary middle-ranking civil servant was trained. This is where the action is more usually is not. This is where training and updating of skills and attitudes is needed. It cannot be afforded from local government budgets and needs to be afforded by our own aid budgets. Let me say that what I've said for Africa is obviously true for other parts of the world, including Europe. As a minister for 10 years, I can be a witness of some of the wishes being absolutely being turned upside down by simply civil servants which were not aware of the new policies. Bad communication inside the administration is quite often also responsible for a bad performance of that administration. Well, you say that that's Africa, or Asia, or South America. And as I said, it's also Europe. Our own bureaucracies are subject to the same criticism. Ministers or Director General proclaim their commitment to sound and investor-friendly practice. But in most of our member states, and I dare say the Commission as well, the middle-ranking, middle-aged civil servant who has to implement the policy, by the way, is rarely a woman, has been brought up to believe in the virtue of the controls and obstructions to enterprise, and is above all absolutely determined that not a single penny of public money shall find its way into the hands of the private sector. Third, the framework of policies has to be right, with stable and convertible currencies, low inflation, equitable taxes, low government deficits, markets for goods, labor and capital, which are allowed to work efficiently, incentives for saving, and an end to the pervasive state involvement in production and controls, which formerly drove the private sector underground or out of the country. The battle of these is well engaged, and in many countries is substantially won, but it is not yet full over. The European Community joins its voice to others, encouraging its partners in cooperation to complete their economic reforms. Fourth, in the interest of reducing poverty, sustaining development, preventing social antagonisms, and promoting democratic participation, we need to ensure that the fruits of growth are shared widely, and especially by the poor. The UNDP's new 97 Human Development Report reiterates the old message that growth alone will not relieve the lot of the poor. This is true if the poor do not have the means, the education, the health, the transport, the land, capital and technology, to take advantage of rising income, to find jobs or remunerative self-employment. Human resource development and support for peasant farming, infrastructure for the poor and for the small enterprise, have always been center stage in financial technical cooperation under the Lomé Conventions. The private sector can only benefit. It needs educated and trained labor, markets for its products, and political and social stability. In its long-term interest, it must also contribute through its taxes to the provision of these basic services. In the Commission, we still doubtless have many lessons to learn about how to revive and revigorate the private sector. But I am proud that the programs which I am responsible for have had some clear successes, even in sub-Saharan Africa, about whose prospects there is so much misplaced pessimism. I am thinking of the popular and financially viable lending program for small and medium enterprises in Kenya, managed by the European Investment Bank, and about the successful technical assistance provided by the Center for Development of Industry to export-oriented fish processing in Uganda and cut flowers in Tanzania. In West Africa, we are among the sponsors of the highly effective network of Entrepreneur, which is doing invaluable service in highlighting the problems facing entrepreneur and lobbying governments. We are also among the backers of imaginative programs of regional economic integration and cooperation in both West, East, and Southern Africa, which aim specifically to improve the business environment and to involve the private sector in reforms. We are backing success in countries as far apart and as different as Uganda, Cote d'Ivoire, or Mozambique. I look forward to a more effective European contribution to a virtuous circle of development with a revitalized private sector as its motto. We will not only be investing European resources in raising capabilities and investment in the private sector, but we will also be paying closer attention to other factors which make for self-sustaining growth. in developed countries, domestic savings and incentives are a critical element determining levels of investment and education, investment and efficient markets, all the key to rising productivity. My vision for the future cooperation is one where we support governments in striving for better governance, more efficient and effective administration and legal services, better financial management and less waste. This will give higher government savings and better social services. We should support economic stabilization and pro-business policies and more participation of the private sector in dialogue with governments. At the same time, we can develop our support for capacity building and the supply of finance for the private sector, especially for small enterprises, to accelerate its acquisition of skills, know-how, and productive capacity. We can help the private sector to help itself by providing seed capital for new commercial sources of finance and of know-how in the private sector. The role of development cooperation is to help to improve the public policy and institutional environment, financial intermediation between savers and investors, and the level of human resources and technical and management capabilities available to the private sector. We should not substitute aid for local savings and skills, nor undermine the emergence of local markets in capital and expertise. In all of this, the hardest job may well be changing attitudes in public administration. A mindset has to be altered. This takes time, patience, and effort. Ministers and directors have to communicate, to offer reward and incentives, to monitor the perception of outsiders, and to measure the performance and achievements of their departments. Ministers and public service, directors in developing countries should make the effort. Every week, I visit my officials of my Directorate General. I don't summon them to me. I go to them. I talk to them about my thinking and listen to their thinking in their offices. Push the message down. Listen to the feedback. It's an old message. It's capacity building. It needs to be done as much at home as abroad. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here in London. So all European commissioners say when they visit. Of course, all of us always tell the truth. But for all of us, this phrase has been more true at some times than others. At other times, it has not been easy to keep smiling. We have been faced with a hostile press, a partly hostile parliament, and a government which could do nothing to restrain this hostility, and sometimes had a declared policy from London of known cooperation. I sense a move towards a more constructive and warmer relationship, and not just by the government. This is, of course, very welcome at the personal level. More importantly, it is very welcome for those who believe in the future of Europe and want Britain to be at the heart of Europe, to quote a defeated politician. Another part of the British genius is your nation's capacity to form fruitful alliances and to keep to them. The alliance with my own country, Portugal, is the oldest and most continually successful. It has now more than 600 years. The alliance with mainland Europe is the most important there has ever been, outside times of war, of course. It was a Dutch historian, Peter Geyl, who voiced what many of us from smaller nations feel. Writing in the 70s, before UK membership was achieved, he said, and I quote, "It is impossible to think of building Europe without Britain, with Britain outside. Britain, which three times has stood for in the breach for European liberties, and the last time the most glorious." Three times? Well, yes, of course. You remember two old wars, but you tend to forget about Napoleon, who tried to unite Europe in a way unacceptable to most of us. He was defeated finally at Waterloo, close to where I now live. The anniversary fell yesterday, June the 18th. Wellington led on that day, 1815, an army of alliance, British, Belgians, Dutch, Brunswickers, Hanoverians, and, in the nick of time, Prussians. We had developed his alliance-forming skills in that most difficult of theaters, the Iberian Peninsula. Britain can no longer change the world standing alone, as you did then. Through Europe, this grandest of grand alliances, you can. In Africa, after the decade of regression in the 80s, Europe has contributed to a decade of reform, which, as we approach its end, could well come to be called the decade of hope and promise in Africa. The challenges are, as I have said, peace, good governance, and progressive poverty reduction, and human development sustained by growth driven by the private sector. The next decade, after the turn of the century, after Lomé IV, could become the decade of success in achieving this agenda. To achieve what we need, to achieve that, we need to work together in Europe and in Africa with all the determination and skill we can muster. British skill, British skills, and British experience in both the public and private sector can make a decisive contribution to that potential success. I earnestly hope and pray that we will be mobilized by British determination on the part of this government and above all of its people. Thank you very much.